Don't you?
All right. Just one more time.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one.
Yes, we are on the air. 90.7 FM. WGXC, let me do the first, very first station ID. You are tuned to WGXC 90.7, servicing Accra, Catskill, and Hudson, Columbia and Greene County. Woo! Thank you, Matt, for the show.
WS Graves, crashing into me,
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by the Highway Drive-In, a four-screen drive-in movie theater in Coxsackie, New York. Information and schedule at hiwaydrivein.com.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Tim of New York, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity...
2, 1, 2. All right. Well, I hope you're still with me. I had some kind of technical difficulty there, and I don't know what it was. But apparently I'm on the air.
2, 1, 2, 1, 2. All right. Still with me.
Amazing.
I had some kind of technical difficulty there, and I don't know what it was. But apparently I'm on the air. 1, 2, 1, 2.
Alright, now I'm closing that, and hopefully that'll be over. We'll stop looping the loop and get on with Good Night, Norman. Gina Barnes. I mean, Dino Buzzati. This isn't the story I want to read. This is from a collection I found, called The Bewitched Bourgeois. It's a publication of the New York Review of Books. 50 stories edited and translated from the Italian with an introduction by Lawrence Venuti. There's also 4 other books by the author, Dino Buzzati, published by New York Review of Books. Doesn't say who, right? Different translators. The Stronghold is translated by Venuti, Lawrence Venuti. There's also one called The Love Affair. Another one called Poem Strip. And another one called The Singularity. Okay, I'm going to read you a story from this book, this collection of 50 stories, called The Scriveners, which apparently was first published in 1967. Sorry, I lost my page trying to restart my phone and figure out what the heck was going on. The Scriveners. At Last, by Dino Buzzati. In the immense room stand hundreds, thousands of tables aligned in rows. On each table lies a typewriter. At each table sits a man. We are writing hundreds, thousands of reports, histories, tales for our Lord and Master. We are the scriveners of the King. Every so often a royal page passes to gather written sheets. Our Lord, however, may not read everything we produce. In fact, some of us continue to write throughout our entire lives knowing our Lord and Master hasn't read a single line of what we've written. We are the scriveners of the King. I, too, have been writing here for many, many years. Directly in front of me works sociologist Antonio Scocciari. Entrusted with the composition of speeches for the high ministers. On my left sits journalist Gelino Weisshorn, one of those cold reserve types. At my right is a historian, Professor Miro Castelnuovo, my good friend. And behind me is Ascanio Indelicato, a poet. May heaven forgive him. Suddenly, an energetic clicking issues from my typewriter. A small red bulb burned on the keyboard, and everyone turned around to look at me. They turned because the noise and light signified my doom. From this instant on, through the inscrutable design of our master, I had to continue writing without end, except for the briefest pause required to satisfy my bodily needs. If I stopped, it would mean my death. How did my colleagues regard me? With pity or envy? Had I really been condemned, or was I rather chosen? The slang term we assign this weighty investiture is, quote, the call, end quote. It seldom occurs. In 9 years, for example, no one in our room had received it. In 5 years, no one had worked under it. Scriveners of a certain age always happen to be called, rarely young ones. This fact leads many to maintain it isn't a punishment, but rather a mark of distinction awarded by our Lord, who values the work of a particular scrivener very highly, and fears this subject may request a pension or stop producing. So the restraint he applies is the threat of death. Others are convinced, however, that the call depends not on a positive assessment, but sheer caprice, as often pleases the powerful. They cite ancient cases of scriveners who were called even though they possessed only mediocre abilities. There are many more disagreements on the effect of the call. Some think death is threatened because discontinued activity weakens the scrivener's mind and saps his energy, so that in a short while the man yields, stops writing, and abandons himself to his destiny. Others hold instead that the fatal alternative stimulates the scrivener and increases his strength, rejuvenating him, so that the designate resists for a very long time, actually writing reports, histories, and tales of always greater perfection. But if the scrivener stops, how does he die? When I lose my strength, how will death overtake me? The master is uncertain. In general, the intervention of the court executioner can be ruled out. 'There is no violent death. It is rather assumed to be a squalid end by starvation, since the unfortunate one has come to lose the favor of the Lord and Master. That is the only true reason for existing. But there is yet another theory of the threat. There is yet another theory. The threat of death is merely platonic. When the scrivener stops working, Sire pardons him, and, unknown to all, even orders that a prize be awarded him. What patent delusions! A clicking was heard in my typewriter. The red light flashed on. Everyone turned around to look at me. I alone in the immense room was called. At the end of the working day, everyone else will leave. I shall remain seated to write on and on deep into the night. And at dawn, after a brief nap on a cot set up in a corner by the custodian, I shall resume my labor. Never will there be a day of rest or a vacation. And if one day I can't continue anymore and abandon the keyboard forever, it will be my end. Professor Castanello, the historian who works at my side, is old now, and he cares about me. "Don't worry," he says. "If you've been called, it's a sign our master has great esteem for you. But don't you understand? I can't move from here anymore. In a little while, you'll go home and see your family again. You can amuse yourself, laugh, have fun, take strolls through woods and fields. I can't. For me, there's nothing but writing and more writing. How long can I hold on? Who knows? It's also possible our lord and master, enamored of the things you write, will come down here in the middle of the night to find you, and perhaps invite you to one of his legendary orgies. For some reason or other, you're different from the rest of us. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been called. Consider me, on the other hand. I'm a historian. I'm old and tired. Today I finished the last sentence of a treatise on late medieval diarchies, which will be my last work, because tomorrow, as you know, I am retiring. But I envy you. I leave the scene obscure and neglected. I know very well our lord and master loves tales like yours and isn't interested in history. This isn't true. I heard, on the contrary, that in the last few years he had such an intense enthusiasm for history, he almost never read anything else. These are brief verbal exchanges because we can't be distracted for too long. The important thing is to write and write. He his history, I my idle tales. Yet in a little while, Castanello will leave, and I shall continue to work. Daylight slowly fades. Night begins to fall. Ding! The bell rings and to signal the end of the working day. The hundreds, thousands of fellow scriveners around me stop beating their keys in unison. Stand up. Put plastic covers over their typewriters and start for the exit. Melancholy ants throwing furtive glances at me. I remain behind. Professor Castanello has also stood up. He looks at me and smiles kindly. Goodbye, dear friend. This is the last evening we shall be together. Don't be frightened. You are a designate, one of the elect. I leave in obscurity. Now I need only rest. He takes his plastic cover from a small drawer, opens it, and holds it in the shape of a dome to cover the instrument of his concluded labor. Click, click. Twice a sharp, malign clicking comes from Castanello's typewriter, and on the keyboard, the little red bulb is lit. He, too, has been called at the very last moment of his career. He stands there petrified. He has turned pale as ice. Yet, he slowly lowers the plastic cover and spreads it carefully over the typewriter, smoothing out the creases. He looks at me one more time. No, I can't. Goodbye. I can't handle it. What will be, will be. He is the last to leave the room, heading toward his fate. I alone remained in the deep silence. I turned on the lamp, and in the small cone of light, surrounded by darkness, I write. I write. Well, there you have it. Dino Buzzati, translated by Lawrence Venuti, The Scriveners, from a New York Review of Books publication, a collection of 50 stories titled The Bewitched Bourgeois. And translated from the, translated from the Italian by Lawrence Venuti. Okay. Well, I hope you stuck around through my technical difficulties. It seemed like they were 10 minutes long. So, I don't know. You heard that dead silence for that long. And then that weird feedback loop. You might have given up. But hopefully you didn't. Hopefully you're still here. Hopefully you're still listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. Broadcasting his show. Good night, Norman. Live to you right here from the corner of the Hudson Valley. The northeastern corner of the Columbia County. As promised, Juno Barnes. Juno Barnes, of course, is famous for the brilliant novel of lesbian protagonist titled Nightwood that appeared sometime in the 1930s, almost 100 years ago, when there were actually lesbians 100 years ago. Believe it or not, kiddies. Black people, lesbians, homosexuals. They all existed long before you or me. Trying to get comfortable here. Which isn't always easy. It's called The Terrorists by Juno Barnes. In early youth. It's not the comfortable spot. Okay, here we go. I got it. The Terrorists by Juno Barnes. In early youth, Pilat had been very melancholy, though vigorous. This was due to his healthy body and to his imaginative mind. Those people who are in the habit of assuming that a melancholy stomach must accompany a sad mind were rather disconcerted with Pilat's indomitable digestion. About his excesses that never gave him punishment in their passing, and about his unalterable decision to become a necessity in the community. Then his hair had been long and his dress decidedly on the quote-unquote artistic plan. His straight nose had below it a very full and perhaps weak mouth, and above it eyes of a strange, large, and mournful turn. Time shortened the hair a little, and the mouth was covered by a graying mustache. The eyes watered easily, and sometimes during an evening, blood veins would stretch across them. Pilat was no longer vigorous, though for a man of 50-odd, he was robust enough. On the other hand, his melancholy had, so people seemed to think, disappeared altogether. Those who knew him longest made the mistake of calling him, quote, more like a human being, end quote. And those who knew him the shortest made the correct judgment that he was, quote, drinking too much, end quote. His early love of the people had sent him toward them, eagerly. Being close to them and in with them, he learned how pitifully weak they all were, and his strong digestion made him despise them for those qualities that somehow he blamed on environment and not heredity. Accepting as one can inherit the filth of the gutter and the starvation of the ash pile. And along with his interest, his study, and his acknowledgments of its inevitability came this robust hate. From speaking of the people as the unfortunate, he spoke of them as the miserable. And in the way he said this word, there was no sound of pity for their sad, shabby hearts. There was only a knowledge that their garments were also shabby and mournful. Had Pilat come from a less cleanly family, he would have loved them very strongly and gently to the end. But he had been comforted and maimed in his conception and his love by too many clean shirts. He still longed to correct things, but he wanted to correct them as one cleans up a floor, not as one binds up a wound. He shouted because his heart was heavy. He began to awe those of his own group. Soon enough, they called him the terrorist. And in the end, when he made a gesture of pity, people raised their arms to protect themselves. He had a very young wife, a weak-chinned, small thing, about 27 years old. She had been nicknamed Joan of Arc because of a certain pale loveliness about the frail oblong of her face. She had lost two or three teeth, and she smoked innumerable cigarettes, drank beer on half holidays, and flirted with anyone whom she despised. She believed in the vanity of all things and the pessimism in all things, and she wanted to annihilate any slovenly ease of mind in herself, so she deliberately set about annihilating her own soul and her own delicate, sensitive, and keen insight. She wore heavy boots that seemed to be drawing her down. Thus, her 5 feet looked like three. Her hair was cut short after the manner of intellectuals among the women of her set, and she wore loose and dirty blouses smeared with paint and oil. She was in the cafes all the afternoon from 3 till 6 when she cleared out for the pigs. The smug and respectable who brought their wives and children to dine. Again at 9 she was back talking about the revolutionists. Pilat had written some poems and had them published obscurely. These she always carried around with her, reading them aloud or studying them nonchalantly. She had long grown tired of them, but she wanted to puzzle the strangers who filtered in, and she wanted to add, when asked about them, by Pilat Korb, you know, the terrorist, never referring to the fact that he was her husband. This she left for others to whisper. She liked to be the center of whispers, for then she could be impersonal and forget herself without any danger of falling into obscurity. Among her friends, she would permit herself the pleasure of pretending to feel human suffering very deeply. She would swing her arms about, imitating Pilat. She would lean far back in her chair, as he did when he had finished his sentence, as, "I know you call me crazy, but that's not all. I have a retort to make, an accusation. Yes, you, the people, what do you know? Are you not being swindled on every side, and yet you submit? Fools, fools," he would shout. "You're always horribly conscious of your bones, and you begin to think that it is as it should be. You say, this is life. Ha! Huh. He would then end up leaning far back, as his wife did when she copied him, thinking that she was expressing herself. And sometimes her friend said, well, certainly, there you are, while they drank beer or devoured large, ill-shaped sandwiches. She would say, you wander, my poor friends, wander about the world like shadows. We must find you your bodies once again. She said we, with that intonation used by agitators. These two lived in a dismal little garret high above the rest of the sad houses of the shabby side street. The building had once been some kind of church or house of devotion, but had long ago been turned into rooms and was now frequented by a vocalist, a violin and piano teacher, and a few out-at-knee artists. There was never any lock on the outer door, approached by three rickety steps. Two or three iron mailboxes clung to the walls, and in the winter, when the wind howled hardest and the snow made park benches impossible, tramps and derelicts of all kinds would creep in here and sleep along the walls near the dry wood of the steps. Their garret had been at one time very dignified and almost elegant, as its tall lines and its heavy wood proclaimed. Its windows and the architecture of the roof spoke of a past that had been no mean thing. Now it was like a woman who had fallen from wealth and distinction and esteem, who had lost all her admirers but not quite all her looks, who passes her remaining days in that odd mixture of clothes that look so strange together, a silk and beribboned petticoat hidden by a calico dressing gown, a torn stocking thrust into small and delightfully fashioned slippers, a well-appointed mouth closing on crumbs. Such was the room to which of an evening Pilat and his little wife climbed. Sometimes the sleeping men in the hall would be awakened by their late arrival and would turn over, muttering abuse, or some of them accepted Pilat's invitation to have a drink with him. Thus he would collect a party that often made merry until the small hours of the morning, or Pilat would bring some of his friends with him. They led the life of actors, sleeping into the late afternoon and staying up half or all of the night. Toward the end of his career, Pilat began to tear his mustache out. When remonstrated with, he would say, I'm preparing to show my teeth. He had become very nervous and excitable and unhappy. He felt that the world was not going in the direction that he had wished. It neither turned toward his solution early enough, nor did it, on the other hand, succumb to its final end as he had predicted soon enough for him. He was tired of living out his life and watching others live out theirs on the prescribed gradual plan. He was annoyed with the passage of time. It infuriated him that 24 hours were still a day and that there were 7 days a week, as there had been when he was born. He no longer wrote poetry or plays, nor did he keep up his connection with a paper which he had started and which spoke harshly of all things. He had taken more and more to his bottle, and because he was very nervous, he drank too much, and because he drank too much, he became more and more excitable. Instead of writing his poetry, now he laid it in among the strands of his wife's hair. In his occasional tender stroking, when he would call her little one and sometimes sniffle snuffle, when he would burst out laughing heartily at her disconcerted countenance. She knew well enough that Pilate saw through her would-be ferocity and her assumed interest in the world. After all, she was only a little girl who, because she was interested, thought that she must assume fury, and because she was too lazy to dress her hair after the fashion. She cut it off. Yet, there was something strange about Pilate's wife. She did not like the society of silly and vain women, and she did not turn most naturally to such men as her husband moved among. Perhaps it started in a torn shoe and a consciousness that only in such society are shoes valued more for the past they have come to than for what they had been originally. She had never much sympathy for society, and a marriage of money disgusted her, though her family had, in the beginning, some such vain ideas about her. They were respectable people who owned a little estate somewhere near the sea, who had been dropped in successive generations into the midst of old and tarnished jewelry comprising the family splendor. Most of this they had given to their daughter, and when they had their first ambitions in the way of a well-to-do doctor in the village, and which their daughter had promptly pawned. Sometimes, it is true, this jewelry would come back, piece by piece, and appear on her wrist or about her neck or from her ears, and at such times she drew a little aside from her husband and his friends, and would sit dreaming in a corner, her red wrists about her little crooked knees. On one such night as this, Pilate had acted very strangely indeed. He had passed several morose hours by himself, and finally at a cafe located his wife, wearing this mysterious and migratory jewelry. The sight of these gems and silvers always put him into a passion either of avarice or contempt. He would get hold of them and realize money on the spot, or he would very bitterly place them on the table before him and solemnly demand that they be cleared away with the rest of the rubbish. His wife would become silent, smiling a little, her head thrown back, or if the waiter did make a motion to sweep the trinkets away, she would say in a loud voice, "Yes, that's right, take them away, feed them to the chickens, make a meal of them, I'm tired of supporting them." Then Pilate cried in a terrible fury, catching the dazed waiter by the wrist and swearing at the top of his voice in Romanian, Italian, and French, saying that he was being treated like a man who has not come honestly by his decorations. From this, he went off into a melancholy reverie. He answered nothing in the way of a question and ordered innumerable bottles of wine. When, accompanied by three or four friends, they finally reached their house, Pilate threatened to kill the vocalist who was teaching someone to sing in the room below them, it being 12:30. "What is all that racket about?" he demanded, flying down the steps and pounding on the door of the vocalist's room. A thin, yellow-faced woman, the vocalist in question, opened the door sharply, thrust her head out, and said, "Be off with you, you lazy vagabond. In my country, such people as you would be locked up." Pilate struck his chest with his fist. "Locked up, is it?" he demanded, smiling fiercely. "Locked up, you say? That's what I have against this country. They do not let you go home unless you commit something that makes you a little ashamed to say how do you do to the mother of all things. She slammed the door on the implication, "You're crazy." Pilat flew back upstairs, shouting, "Crazy. And did I not warn you that I was crazy, you poor senseless thing? Did I not give myself full credit for it in the very beginning? But does that make it necessary for me to be tortured with the horrible sounds issuing from such lowly throats at Maria's?" The pupil who took the vocal lessons. "And must I forever regret the inferiority of the things Maria is forced to swallow, and of the noise Maria tosses from out her little throat?" He was in the middle of the room by this time and much amassed his friends. His wife leaned back in the corner and twisted the bracelets around and around, blinking her eyelids and shuffling with her feet. "What is it you would do with the little Maria if you had her and could dispose of her as you would, eh?" inquired one man, with a bristling beard and an odor about him of tar. "Where would I be?" demanded Pilat, seating. "What would I do?" demanded Pilat, seating himself with his back to the fire. "I would have her singing in paradise by dawn. After all, I am a man of force. Some day I shall march upon the town and shall show you. It's about time for an uprising when little girls think they can sing and young men think they can govern." "Ah, well, it's a dull season. The autumn is nearly here." "Autumn," retorted Pilat, flourishing his arm, "is the season for destruction. But we are weak, miserable creatures, and we leave to nature all the tearing down of the scenery. And to her we leave all the building up of the same scenery next year and the year after, for interminable and tireless and wearisome years." "Well, I tear down the scenery better than all of them," he said irrelevantly. "Than all of them, I would rip the whole existing plan of nature to pieces." How she would shiver. How she would... And how she would implore. "But I should have no mercy. No, not even when she got upon her knees and wept at my feet and covered them with their insufferable tears. I would invite her to suicide. I would mock at the stains upon her cheeks. I would glory at the dirt on the imploring knees. I would laugh aloud and shake her by those horrible, ample shoulders of hers, and would cry out to her, 'Now die, die, we do not care.'" "Tear the little leaves out of your heart. We are in need of them for a bed. Weep. We need a drink. Destroy yourself, for we need a harp on which to sing the songs of freedom." He had become half drunk with his frenzy, and he stood up. "I tell you, I'd say to her, 'We're tired of you. I, Pilat, am tired of you, and she, my little girl, is tired of you, and Maria is tired of you. We are tired of your spontaneity and your persistency and your punctuality. We want to see you dead and smoldering. What'll we do? We'll thrust our feet into your heart because they are cold, and our hands will warm at your palms. And we will shake them at your death, saying, at last you have accomplished more than seasons and beauty. You have created destruction. We can no longer rise in the morning and say, behold, the sun has arisen. We shall no longer send our children to school to learn mathematics. We shall never be connected with you any longer, as at the outcome of your whims. We are set free thus. He snapped his fingers and executed a pirouette. Anicio then sat down, discussing the feasibility of destruction on a large scale. His wife still blinked her eyes in the corner and continued to tell to roll her bracelets. The whole room had such a menacing aspect, such a sad and gloomy atmosphere, and contained as many odors and voices that she was annoyed and wanted to sleep. Sleep had overcome one of the men who leaned against the table. His head had fallen forward, and he snored a little. In the other corner of the room, the conversation had taken a decidedly revolutionary turn. They were beginning to talk of besieging the town. Names were mentioned as persons to destroy. They began to collect things that would do as missiles. The room began to bristle. Dark beards stood out as though their wearers had been scratched. Lips protruded, ears trembled, the very beards began to shake. Fists doubled up, eyes sparkled, and the tongue knew no forbidden thing. There was something at once terrible and beautiful about these men who, rising, suddenly turned for a moment toward the old boards of that room. Such a searching and melancholy gaze that tatters and misery might have seemed for one instant something splendid. Hey, it'll be magnificent. In the dawn we shall do it. In the dawn we shall creep forth to make the world better for men. They'll see us coming, creeping on all fours, and they'll say, here are the rats. They shall learn what rats can do. Some of the men stretched a little among the empty bottles. Pilat began to drowse, a heavy paperweight in his hand. John, his bosom friend, leaned near with the broken leg of a chair firmly clenched in his hand, and he whispered a little to make it more menacing. The fire had died down and barely a light flickered. Pilat's head fell forward on his chest. The bristling beards, one by one, relaxed and rested once more down in smooth, silky lines. Deep breathing took the place of cries, oaths, imprecations. Pilat's wife stirred uneasily in her corner, dreaming, her hand over her bracelets. She woke up It was midday. She looked out into the street. A postman was standing on the steps of the door opposite, and a woman with a baby in pink ribbons moved slowly out toward the park. She woke up. It was midday. She looked not into the street. She looked out into the street. A postman was standing on the steps of the door opposite, and a woman with a baby in pink ribbons moved slowly out toward the park. She stumbled over Pilat and two or three of the men huddled together for warmth. All of them, in their sleep, had moved away from those things that they had collected as weapons. They had rolled onto them, and they found that they hurt and were uncomfortable. The chair leg lay beside the paperweight. She stretched, opened her mouth, and yawned. She looked about for a cigarette stub and found it, lighting it slowly. She prepared the little oil stove for the reception of the old and stained coffee pot. She looked out of the window again. It was a splendid day. She thought of her favorite cafe. And she smiled as she contemplated one or two new phrases she would use in relation to life. She put Pilat's book in her pocket. The coffee began to boil. Okay, well, there you have it. Another episode of Good Night Norman with me, your host, Norman Douglas, right here on WGXC 90.7 FM, community radio for open ears, WGXC.org. Radio for the rural. For some of the rest of the world. It was a rough day, folks. Not that it was even particularly rough. It was just a way that was put myself in a situation where I could not do anything. I didn't even try to do anything because everything just screamed, don't do anything. And so I didn't. I sat there. Then I got here and there was like the technical difficulties. Interesting. Tuesday night at the Half Moon. If you're in Hudson, New York, there's a last minute holiday market. So the bookstore guy is going to be there. I'm going to be there. Slinging poems, not booze. There'll be music, food. Come on down, Tuesday, December 16th, Half Moon, Bar and Pizza. Opens at 4 a.m. every day but Sunday. Okay, you've been listening to Good Night Norman. This is WGXE 90.7 FM, WGXE.org. Go to the website, click the